Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Sean Modi. Sean's the founder and CEO of Capital AI. Sean, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Excited to have you on. Let's start with Capital AI. What problem is it solving in the market?
Yeah, well, with Capital AI, what we built is the intelligence engine for financial services and government agencies, particularly national security. Companies are overwhelmed by data. They're overwhelmed by choice in AI. And that's creating, a governance nightmare when it comes to procuring AI tools and token spend. So Capital helps you solve that problem. Our technology connects to our customers' data. And with AI agents that have the institutional knowledge of that organization can produce automations. So those automations can be things like PowerPoint due diligence documents, Excel workbooks, interactive web applications. What's also unique about the product is that it's model agnostic. So we have over 500 different AI models that power these agents. So it really gives control to our customers.
Wow. I didn't even know we were up to 500 models.
Yeah, there's a lot of models.
I believe it. I'm sure we haven't seen anything yet. How long you been at it?
We started the company in 2021, really got going in 22. Went through Y Combinator in summer 24, and since then I've just been accelerating.
Fantastic. What inspired you to apply to the YC?
Oh, well, my alma mater is Airbnb. So I was one of their founding product designers and helped design the user experience alongside the incredible team and founders there. But Airbnb was a YC company. And I was, we built something really unique, and I was spending time with my dear friend, CEO and co-founder of Airbnb, Brian Chesky. I was at his house in San Francisco. And he looked at me after I gave him the demo of our product at the time. He said, "Man, you're really onto something here. You remind me of, you know, Airbnb right before we did Y Combinator. Like, you had a great idea, but you need, you know, YC can really help you accelerate it, tighten up your value prop." And he was right. So we already missed the application deadline, as Airbnb missed the application deadline, famous story. There was an exception made. We still had to apply and do all the grind, the application. Spent the next few days doing it and met Gary Tan, the president and CEO, went through the interview, and fortunately we got in. So it's kind of a pattern match to the Airbnb story.
Well, congratulations. And I'm sure that's a precursor for the success that Capital AI is going to have. You know, for the benefit of the founders in the audience, you know, before we move off, just your experience with accelerators in general, if you want to comment on Y Combinator too, great. But, you know, any key takeaways that you think are worth sharing, we're all ears.
Yeah. Y Combinator, I think, is really like a national treasure. It's an international treasure because there's so many international founders that come to build their companies in the U.S. Whether a company gets in or not, it's a great forcing function to tighten up your product value proposition, how you talk about your product, what differentiates you, the legal structure of your organization, all the good housekeeping that goes into building a durable company that is set up right from the beginning and provides value to customers. So I think the application process alone is really, really powerful. But assuming you get into YC, it's special. It's kind of like design school. I studied industrial design. I went to RISD, and the design process is iterative. So we had what's called critiques and studio time on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And there's one big presentation a week. It was always on Tuesday. So every week you're working really hard to get to that next milestone. And YC works in a very similar way. You have your bigger events one day a week with the broader Y Combinator cohort. And then you have a small breakout session once a week with your section. So that I find to be really useful because it basically builds a battle rhythm for you and your co-founder to keep moving forward, keep shipping product, keep talking to customers, and keep innovating. So those are just the high level things. I advised Techstars Space Cohort a while back, and I think they were really good too. I don't have too much exposure to the other ones, but I imagine like any group environment where you're building things with other founders who are talented, only good will come from it.
Yeah, I mean, it's so intuitive, and to hear you validate is great. I mean, community is so important, but also surrounding yourself with like-minded individuals who are pursuing the brass ring. I mean, it's especially if somebody's competitive. You mean I can imagine you're just like, oh, you're pressing hard, I'm gonna press hard.
Yeah. It's not like, you don't, it's not about like winners and losers. It is competitive because you don't want to look like the company that's not, didn't do their work or is not succeeding. But you learn from your colleagues. There's all these different disciplines, people building in different domains, whether it be video or, life sciences or robotics. But that's overall just inspiring. And that, there's ideas that you learn and bring into your own creative process as a founder. So, couldn't recommend it more highly.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, environment so important. And I'm yeah, it probably also makes a case for having an office, though I work remote. It is on
Yeah.
the list. But you made a comment before the accelerator, when you started the company, that there was I'm inferring, but there was a pivot maybe at the first year or two. How what was it, and how'd that unfold?
Well, I think one thing, the word pivot is kind of has this funny connotation. Every company is always pivoting. It just depends how severe the turn is. One of my for instance, one of my close early former clients, one of the design studio company called Brex, they started off as a VR company and then went into financial services. That'd be like a hard pivot. We started off always around bringing together multiple AI models and data to create stories, meaningful fact-based stories. But our first go-to-market was healthcare, and particularly health insurers. And we learned a lot from that. Actually, we made a bunch of revenue, delivered value. But then this tectonic shift happened in the marketplace called large language models, and those being made available via API. And the tsunami of change was coming, and we weren't able to bring those technologies to that use case. Furthermore, we learned that the sales motion for insurers, health insurers, is very slow and challenging. So big
I thought you were going
technology.
to say long and painful.
Long and painful, just to be blunt about it. Yeah, it's long and painful. New technology. So we made the decision to re-architect our tech stack on multiple LLMs instead of pure ML-based models, and we went after a broader cohort of customers. And by there's this interesting tension. I was talking to one of my advisors this week around being broad and having a very capable tool that can do a lot of things versus being very specific, like you're solving for this one particular issue in banking or insurance, right? And what we did, we built a product that's quite flexible, and we use that as a way to then get specific through the broad. So by building that, it allowed us to learn faster and then hone in on those use cases for customers where, the revenues were there, and most important, we could create value.
Well, yeah, it's funny. I think I recall you saying that. Maybe you didn't say that pivot has a derogatory term, but maybe hone in on the fact that all businesses evolve. And I think it's a great call out. I think a lot of founders start companies with a premise. Premise is informed by experience, but we always operate with a shortage of information. And so, until you actually get in the market, start selling, talk to your clients or potential clients, totally fine if your worldview changes. In fact, I'd argue you have a responsibility to not try to force a square peg in a round hole, or at least recognize what you're passionate about.
And there is a difference between B2B, like selling to businesses versus selling to consumers. That that's a very big caveat. I mean, but ultimately, enterprise users, customers are, they're people. They like to use simple tools that provide value for them. But selling a consumer product, it's a very different motion and execution path than selling AI systems to regulated and sensitive customers. So bear that in mind. So with regards at least to the B2B side, you have to stay really, really close to what those customers are saying, what they need, what they're not saying, and try to figure out what questions need to be asked so that you can build a product that solves a problem for them, and then find adjacencies to other organizations like them.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head too, especially early stage where your runway could be limited,
Oh yeah.
and then you marry that against a long sales cycle. It's like,
Oh yeah.
the longer your payback period is, the more cash you have to have on hand. And so I find myself in these conversations where, like, look, I think everyone loves to sell to enterprises, and especially, as you start looking at nine figures plus a top line, you're almost forced to. Obviously, that's not a rule per se, but I also think it's a good to say that you're allowed to have a progression. I mean, I know plenty of successful businesses that, started with consumers or small businesses, maybe consumers, but as the company grew, they went up the business or increased business size of who they were selling to.
Yeah, one of my favorite companies of all time is Lego, and they Lego originally started as a wood shop, and then became a toy maker, a wood toy maker, and then over time kept iterating. It was always in the spirit, though. I think if you look at the founding of Lego, it's in toys and thoughtful play and learning for kids. But that quintessential Lego brick did not come till much later, and after much pain and suffering of the founder, and then his kids that he brought into the business. It's a great story for the other founders out there who like that stuff.
It was a couple years ago, but I think someone did a documentary on Lego.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, maybe we'll see if we can't get someone from the team to list that in the show notes. But I think it's a great
Yeah.
example. You're allowed to evolve,
Oh,
and
yeah.
who knows what the next iteration is going to look like, or if it's going to be considered more valuable than the previous one. So awesome. What was the trajectory leading up to Capital AI? What inspired you to start the company?
Yeah, well, my background, as mentioned, studied industrial design. I went to a school called RISD, Rhode Island School of Design. I think it's the oldest design school in America. I worked on the space program with NASA, designing lunar vehicles and a lunar base, lunar habitat. And then joined Motorola as an industrial designer, designing rugged mobile devices for companies like FedEx, UPS, the Army, and then was recruited to Google and moved out to California and worked on search maps. And then personalization, connecting Google properties with common identity. I was very fortunate enough to work with directly with Sergey Brin, the co-founder. And then I built a visual search engine for comparative shopping for products, art, and fashion. And that ended up being acqui-hired to Airbnb, where I joined as their founding product designer, which was an amazing journey. And building Airbnb was, an experience that still deeply affects me today. After my time at Airbnb, I wanted to design a variety of products and really stretch my wings. And so I built a design studio, and that's where I would work with early stage founders like companies like Brex or Modern Fertility or Product Hunt, designing their user experience, helping them working directly with founders, shaping their vision into elegant product UX that could address their business need, but also delight their users. And during that time, I started advising the government and working directly with the White House as well as the Department of Defense on different programs. One of them being a logistics program during COVID that the government spun up to spin up machine learning models to identify supply chain risk around military bases. And what users, these analysts sitting at NORTHCOM, NORAD, were tasked with 7 days a week producing these PowerPoint decks and reports for policymakers and leadership on what's going on. So looking at forest fire potential in California with COVID infection and critical supply chains for to treat, senior citizens with electronic medical equipment, these very specific security related issues. And they didn't want to use 16 different dashboards built by 16 different vendors. They wanted a single architecture to bring AI models, data, and create these things in a programmatic way, and then they could, with a human in the loop, modify them. So that's where the light bulb went off for capital. Hence that natural progression into healthcare, given that COVID was just like the greatest health event of our lifetimes. So that's how I, once I had the idea, going into that market was the next logical step.
Wow. So that's an amazing set of experiences. I bet you we can
Thank you.
probably unpack every one. The first one that I find myself gravitating towards is design. So we're recording this, what's today, June 18th?
Yeah.
I think it was yesterday I saw Anthropic posted a pop-up on my Claude saying they were just about to re release Anthropic Design. And I tell you the first thought, I mean, I didn't have a moment to like spend on it, but I've got you now, so I'm going to ask. One of the things I think about artificial intelligence, it is a, my opinion is it's a tool, but it's we're I don't we're still not at a point where you can replace human creativity, despite seeing amazing pieces of art and video. Love to know how you think about it, having spent a good part of your career embedded in design.
Yeah, well, thanks. Well, I appreciate you asking the question. So, AI is impacting all aspects of society, whether it be you're an auditor at a global professional services firm, or you're an intelligence analyst at a government agency, or if you are doing outbound sales, right? AI, these are all tools you can use to help speed up your work, or d deliver more work products in a shorter period of time. Does design it people often think of design as purely aesthetics, but design, when done properly, is a creative process that helps you build products and services that are desirable, meaning people want to use them, engage with them. They're functional, meaning they actually work. They deliver some tangible and real value, and viable, meaning that it helps accomplish a business objective. So designers are, they're left and right brained. They're folks that are technical, that understand, enough about engineering to be deadly, but also understand the world of aesthetics and experience, and there's this word du jour, taste. So when designers are integrated in a product development process properly, they are exploring multiple solutions to a problem, and they're bringing people together, engineers, business leaders, marketing, to provide feedback on those conceptual directions. So let's say you're doing a new onboarding flow for a new bank that you're building. It's a lot faster and cheaper to have designers in collaboration with engineers provide feedback on these, work on these onboarding flows, than it is for engineers just to go out and just build it straight on. And so you'll get something that encapsulates the qualitative insights of a group and potentially your customers to ensure that what you ship is really high quality. Now, with AI, you can automate the creation of a lot of these workflows, and that just speeds up the designer and designer's workflow, but it creates more, therefore you have more to evaluate. So it's this interesting tension that I think no one has quite frankly dealt with yet, in an effective way of like, okay, so I can build all these workflows ostensibly using templates with things like skills. You can create a stylistic output. But people are, humans are really perceptive, and they can tell when something is purely AI generated versus has the, touch and craftsmanship of a person who knows what they're doing, who's a trained and skilled craftsman. So, I think there's a world for craftsmanship always, right? Because that's innately what makes the human experience real and relevant. It makes it more interesting when you can see the artist's touch. It makes it more interest. It makes it more useful when there's a human that touches the product. You can feel the expression of the intent of the craftsman who made it. That's what makes Apple products so exquisite. It's what makes Airbnb the great product it is today, so on and so forth.
It'll be interesting to see how this evolves and whether or not there's a continued preference for a human touch. My sense is that there will be. I think it depends on the subject, but definitely in all things aesthetic, I can see how it's you'll at least for now, you're going to need human context to make something that is generally appealing. You're right.
Yeah, and it's still faster to have, like, when, like, for instance, we were solving this, you know, with the one of an agentic workflow in Capital. We have this canvas where you add your agents and your data and evals and guardrails, and then you decide what your outputs are. And when you run it, there's auditability of every step of the agent, what it's doing, what data sets it's accessing, what decisions it's making. You can chat with, the design tool and ask it to improve it, but there's so much nuance in that right pane of where the sequence of events happens that it's still faster for a human to make those design calls than it is to burn tokens and hoping that your laser beam hits the right spot. The AI laser beam hits the right spot in that side pane. And then waiting there is kind of annoying, and obviously speed, let's assume AI will get faster and faster. It will. But there's still a huge delta between, like, a smart designer who knows what they're doing, making an improvement in a quick turn in about, 30 minutes and exploring a few different options, that accounts for the technical requirements of the product versus just burning tokens and asking AI to do it for you.
I mean, it makes great sense. I mean, it mirrors my own experience. When I put my CFO hat on, that at least today, again, when I engage, I mean, I don't know. It's not even about hallucinations. It's just lack of context, and I don't. At least I don't see we're at a point yet where this ceases to be a tool.
Oh yeah, it's absolutely a tool. You can think of them as templates, templatized. And if you want to use a template, you can use that template, or unless you want to make something new and novel, that where you and AI can aid you in making that new and novel thing, but you don't just hand it off to the machine and say, "Make me the best website ever." That's green, right? There's a lot of the machine does not and never will have full context that a person does.
Nor does it does nor does it know what shade of green may be most.
Right, exactly. There's a
Yeah,
lot of shades of green.
there are a lot of shades of green. So let's come back to Capital AI. Would love to learn more about your go-to-market strategy, how you're thinking about distribution.
Yeah, that's a great question. Something we think about all the time. So we've honed in on financial services, particularly global professional services. One of our flagship customers is EY, known as Ernst & Young. They've been an amazing partner for them. We are powering diligence workflows. So think commercial due diligence or divestiture. These are incredibly labor-intensive processes that requires people to pore over data rooms with spreadsheets and legal documents, and tasks that take weeks, we can compress to, half a day. There's still always a human in the loop on these things. You're not delegating to the machine. So learning how EY works, they're a 400,000 plus person company. That's been a great experience because we found adjacencies. So that would be banks. So adjacencies would be regulatory compliance automation and helping mid-market and large-scale banks adhere to new policy come at the state level or federal level. So that's another clear go-to-market. And we just, as of yesterday, we're at the American Banker conference and came runner up, the second best product, which was pretty cool. I'll take runner up. So that is an adjacent. So we found that adjacency. Other areas adjacencies are private equity funds that need to do deal diligence as well as complex reporting across their portfolio companies. That's a pretty arduous process. So if building a workflow that allows their PE's portfolio companies to upload their information so they can get a better insight of the performance of their companies, that's another core use case. And then there's a whole government national security go to market. So that would be for the world of financial crime, the world of intelligence, the three letter agencies, for the Department of War. That would be in terms of accelerating procurement timelines, looking at different vendors, the performance of their technologies. For instance, if you're looking at drone capability, looking at the supply chains of those vendors, looking at the performance of those drones on test ranges, it's to rank which ones are most capable of being procured from a security as well as performance standpoint. So that's how we think about our go-to-market. We've built out sales leaders that are responsible for those domains. And we also have our team where our focus is on the US and UK. So that's about 50% of our business is actually in the United Kingdom. And as London becomes the AI innovation hub of Europe, we will expand to the EU from our base in London.
So logical adjacents makes good sense. And how big is the team?
26 people and growing.
Fantastic. And so you said you had leaders leading each domain. Out of curiosity, how often do you find yourself getting directly involved with sales?
Oh, all the time. As a CEO, I think it's of a CEO of an enterprise AI business, it's impossible not to. You want to, I'm my leadership style is very much to like hire great people and let them do their thing. But I like to be involved with sales because I like to hear what the customer demands and what their feedback is. So it keeps me aware so I can have the best context possible to steer the direction of the company. So, delegate, trust but verify.
I think it was Reagan who said that, and I would tend to agree. Our definition is smart and effective, so people who can self-initiate and think critically. But you're right. Probably separate podcasts, but yes, there's definitely a formula when people come and join you for the first time, and confirming fit.
And there's and reaching customers is a whole other interesting piece. So LinkedIn is a great way to, there's content, social content you could put out to drive awareness. But also really targeted and specific experience driven things like hosting dinners with different leaders from across a desired market segment, whether it be private equity or financial services or professional services, and you mix in a diversity of backgrounds and it's just have a thoughtful discussion. And we find those to be great ways to expose one ourselves to folks, but not in an overly sales way. It's actually just more around getting smart people together in a room, having a discussion, and then having a follow-up there if there's interest in talking to us about how we could help their organizations.
Funny how that works. I think it's a bit ironic. The people who sell the most are the ones who are not trying to sell.
It's like I forget the movie, but it's like do nothing. just do. It's like I guess surfing. But no, it's getting really great people just to talk to each other. The power of that, it's like soft diplomacy.
Like that.
It is the most effective I found way to sell.
I agree. There's been a reoccurring theme of the significance of networks, given the way I like to describe it is, intelligence becomes ubiquitous. So where's the premium? It's gonna be on people. I don't I'd say the jury's out if there's a formula, but I think it's, don't have expectations, lead with, offering value. For me personally, and I don't know, I'd love to get your take. I kind of hardwired to do well by people without being asked, but I think we live in a world where you have to ask for the sale. And I, it's, not that it's a bad thing, but I think it's definitely a variable in the formula that doesn't get talked about as much, and I think is good to say, hey, look, I have something here I believe is valuable to you. Do you want it?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, you have to ask at some point. To build funnel is a whole nother thing. Like meaning, what's your top of sales funnel? How do you build leads and then bring them through a process? But at some point, yeah, there has to be a hey, we'd love to do work together. Can you know how, what will it take to make this a reality? I think the interesting piece just in the broader kind of market of AI, there's so much change, right? Like Meta, for instance, they're having their top leaders once a week for several hours, just catch up on all the developments in AI. We as an entire company live that, I mean, every 24 hours. There's so much change in the rate of like new technologies, new competition, new potential regulation. So that is a good thing because it creates openings for startups, but it also is challenging because the legacy businesses that want to procure these capabilities, they're like, whoa, it's overwhelming for them too. So that's where why we built a product that is very easy to use and we can come with minimal effort or minimal custom engineering, we can come to them with a use case that is relevant for them very quickly. Or we have a policy of only show live demos, so only show the real products, so we're able to build artifacts. Those are reports or analysis or dashboards. We do that on the spot live with data that's representative of the data that they would have. So that is how we deal with this very noisy environment.
Adaptability by design.
And showing stuff that's real.
It's, I hadn't really thought about it in that context before of this is evolving fast. You must be, and everyone, I think, by nature, startups are nimble. But actually incorporating it into the product. Who was I listening to? I was listening to someone who was just talking about, if you think about historical, dev cycles, there was a 2-week sprint. And now it's like, no, you need to iterate on not only, yeah, I mean, you have to not only understand your buyers, which has always been the case, but I think that cycle will continue to get compressed.
We're on 1 week release cycles right now.
And so with that, what's the outlook? So you have a, it sounds like you have a solid handle on who your buyers are, how you're going to approach them, an understanding that things are going to evolve, to include the models. Where do you see the things, not only with the company, but the market in a year from now?
It is so our belief is that there will not be a and my belief is that there won't be one model to rule them all. It's just impossible. The stack is complex, right? You have the GPUs, you have inference. There'll be novel ways in which to train LLMs. There'll be novel ways to deploy LLMs. So our belief is that we will move to a world where use the best model for the job or jobs. So that is one thing, and that's what we believe in. The other piece is we believe in sovereignty, and I believe more and more companies will be very concerned, and governments alike are concerned about ownership of data. They want full control over their data holdings, and they don't want to use their proprietary information as training data for an AI lab. The other piece is they will these organizations wants go want governance, they want auditability, and they want repeatability. So that what that means is you don't want a thousand weeds blooming at your organization, because that what that does, while yes, it's kind of like a sugar high of productivity, but it actually creates silos across your organization. So faction of your team is using Copilot, a faction of your team is using Claude Code, another faction is using Gemini, ChatGPT. You may be exposing sensitive data, you may be burning tons of tokens. So organizations are wanting to get their handle on that, and they need to be, there has to be an audit trail of what's being done when, because when you're in high stakes environments, and let's say there's a lawsuit 3 years from now, you need to go back and see what decisions that the AI made to get there. And I would say another piece is the institutional knowledge of your organization, training agents against that. So there's proprietary know-how and tradecraft. We call that tradecraft as code. More organizations are trying to build proprietary workflows that reflect how they do business. They don't want to delegate it all just to Claude Code with some minimal context and see what pops out the other side. So those are the kind of the bigger trends that we're seeing, within capital. I think the pricing of the models is getting pretty wild. Uber famously just put a $1,500 per employee cap on vibe coding per month. Meta has been reported to do the same. We're seeing cost be a major concern. So that begets the question, as the AI labs go IPO, how will that impact their margins? What will they do to make up for that lost revenue if their margins are compressed? So I think that's going to create some headwinds and something to be certainly addressed.
Yeah, I think it makes good sense. I mean, I think we can count on entrepreneurs in this country figuring out how to reduce the cost of compute, and whether that's smaller models or some variation where, to your point, just by virtue of the business, they're gonna want to, something that's a bit more plain vanilla out of the box that they can train on their own and or run locally.
Yeah, and I also think that there still is such a, there are different industries, right? And like there's different experts in those industries. So having, just AI seemingly consume every industry, it won't happen in that way. You still need, a Wall Street Journal reported yesterday, AI sure can replace some investment banking functions, but it can't replace the rainmakers. So the ones that the junior investment bankers that get trained up and actually generate a lot of revenue, that takes skill and creativity and training. So you're seeing the banks actually not do massive headcount reductions. They're actually staying flat, adopting AI. So I think what that means is that there needs to be more emphasis for startups on building domain specific capability when it comes to their marketing, when it comes to how they deploy, so that they really understand the nooks and crannies and workflows of the markets they're serving. So if you're doing an intelligence assessment for a critical government agency, there's a very strict way and developed way in which that's done. You don't want to vibe code your way to that, because people's lives are on the line.
Yeah. No, I think you nailed it. I mean, at least for the foreseeable future, there's a premium on context, and human memory. It'll be see how interesting to see how it evolves. Sean, I really enjoyed this. Unfortunately, we're coming up on time. Before we do, if there's anybody in the audience who wants to get a hold of you, either because they want to join the team, potentially add Capital AI to their tech stack, how can they find you?
Yeah, they can just email me directly, Sean, Shaun, at capital, CAPITOL.AI. You can also visit our website, CAPITOL.AI, capital.AI.
Perfect. And please also look in the show notes. We'll keep it down listed below.
Yes,
Sean,
Legos.
it's fun. Have you my mom's Swedish, so when I was a kid, I got to go to Legoland in Copenhagen, which was cool.
Oh. Nice.
So near and dear to my heart. I was it was kind of fun because the Europeans would get entire Lego sets that they wouldn't sell in the States. I remember picking up on it back in, I guess Toys R Us doesn't exist anymore. But back in the day when it did, and I was like a regular in the Lego aisle, yeah, I mean, I was like, oh, wait, I didn't see this over there. So it was fun.
Awesome. Yeah, well, definitely a great story to read up on. So, I think your listeners will enjoy it.
We'll include it there. Sean, thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.